Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. The beef industry is arguably one of the most dynamic sectors in Canadian agriculture, and it's facing some pretty tough challenges these days. In addition to the never-ending chore of keeping the herd healthy and fed through drought, floods, and polar vortexes, there's always the issue of trade. And now there are some new forces emerging that might curtail beef's traditional role in our diet. Some have labeled cattle production as a major offender in global warming. As foods go, beef is threatened by plant-based sources of protein, alternative meats created in laboratories, and by vegans, vegetarians, and now flexitarians, who are choosing to eat less of it for a whole host of health and ethical reasons. Canadian Cattlemen magazine has been following the beef business in Canada for more than 75 years. The publication has just appointed a new editor, and she's with us here today to talk about some of the current trends in eating and how that might affect the beef business. Joining me now is Lisa Gunther. Hi, Lisa, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Laura.
Now, Lisa, you're new to Canadian Cattlemen, but you're certainly no stranger to the beef industry. Tell us a little bit about your background.
So I grew up on a commercial cow-calf operation in northwestern Saskatchewan. And I'm kind of like seasonal farm help.
Pitching in when needed, like a typical farm kid.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been writing for Grain News and Country Guide for a few years before joining the Cattlemen team.
Well, I'm glad you're with us. Now, you've been seeing and watching some of these trends, and I just wondered, what are your first impressions on how some of these things could feed back through the value chain to what producers do on the farm?
So the beef sector is really taking note of these trends, and one of the ways they respond is actually by doing research on how to improve on farm practices. One of the more recent examples would be how they're looking at how to use painkillers effectively on the farm for procedures like castration. They've been doing this for a while, actually, and I think in some ways they're pretty well prepared for all this increased scrutiny. For example, when you look at the whole traceability system and technology, that could really feed very well into our blockchain future. You know, I think the industry is actually
trying to stay ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look back at 2003 and mad cow disease and the upheaval that caused, that kind of blindsided the industry, and it's almost looks like since then they've stepped up their forward-looking projections.
Yeah, I think it forced change on the industry. And now it's actually got to the point where producers are getting some compensation for their time and extra costs. For example, Cargill's been paying a premium to producers who went through the Verified Beef Production Plus.
Right.
So that's good news.
So these issues are clearly on producers' radar. I know you've been attending some of the industry conferences lately, and you've brought along some interviews with people who are watching these trends really closely and trying to keep the industry abreast of them. Let's start with Timothy Caulfield. Who is he, and where did you catch up to him?
So I caught up with Tim Caulfield at the Sask Beef Industry Conference in Regina a couple of weeks ago. He's a research director at the University of Alberta's Health Law Institute. He's also written 3 books, and he's hosted a documentary series on Netflix, and that series looks at different health trends. So in this interview, he talks about celebrities such as Gwyneth Paltrow, mm-hmm. and how they drive health food trends and what all that means to the beef sector. So, Tim, you mentioned that your old friend, Gwyneth, has claimed that red meat is dirty, so she hasn't eaten it in something like 20 years. What exactly is she talking about, and should we take her advice?
Let's start with the last one. No, you shouldn't take her advice. You know, and it's kind of unclear what she's talking about. And keep in mind, she got this advice from another celebrity, right? And then she claims she hasn't eaten red meat in 20 years, which I also kind of doubt. But it really goes to this idea that there's something inherently unhealthy about red meat. And it's this an idea that's kind of taken hold with the sector of society, despite the fact I don't think there is evidence to back that up. You know, as you know very well, a lot of the evidence is correlational in nature, and not, you know, doesn't get to the causal factors involved. So you know, she's leveraging that, and she's folding it into her wellness gestalt, and people are lapping it up.
Yeah, and you mentioned that was, I was going to ask you as well about the correlation versus causation. How does that relate to some of the information out there about beef?
Well, you can talk about nutrition research in general. You know, so much of it, as you probably know, are these cohort studies where they follow often hundreds of thousands of people over a period of time, and then they'll use recall data or interview data to find out what they've eaten, and then they do a correlation between their eating habits and certain health outcomes. That can be valuable research, and I'm not saying it's totally useless, but it doesn't tell us what's really going on. So if someone's eating a lot of beef, maybe that exact same person is smoking, maybe they don't exercise as much, maybe they eat other things, and so you get this correlation between eating beef and certain health outcomes. And it makes it very unreliable. And I think that that's a problem with all nutrition research. To be fair, it's always going to be hard, right? You know, you can't do a clinical study. It would be very hard to do a long-term clinical study on something like this. But I still think we need to take care in how we interpret all of that.
Some of these celebrity trends are kind of easy to poke fun at, but there can be real harm done. So getting back to kind of the nutritional stuff, for example, with people who are maybe avoiding gluten when they don't, mm-hmm. when there isn't a health reason to do so, what's the harm in that?
You know, I think there are a lot of harms. I actually even think that there is harm with the silly stuff, because, you know, if you're willing to believe magic in one domain, you know, it might be easier to believe magic in another domain, right? So it creates this sort of belief in pseudoscience, which I think is problematic. But you do see real harm, right? You know, you see things like crazy diets that perhaps don't have all the nutritional requirements associated with it. You know, these really restrictive cleanses and detoxes can be unhealthy. They can be bad for you. You know, avoiding whole grains. You know, research has shown that whole grains are good for you. If you avoid them over a lifetime, that can be problematic, right? So a lot of the advice, and it's a little bit of a paradox, right? Because it's being pushed for the purposes of health, but in reality, it's having the opposite effect.
One thing I thought was interesting was we got a question at the end regarding should we be calling it bunk or not? And just tell us your views on that.
Yeah, this is I'm pretty aggressive in that context, right? I do think that when something is ridiculous, we should highlight exactly what the science says. And to be honest with you, maybe the term bunk isn't the best because it creates this adversarial relationship. But I do think we need to say what the science is, you know, set the record straight about the science. But in addition to that, I do think we need to think about the person's values. We need to listen to what are their specific concerns. I think that we need to use creative narratives that speak to different communities. So I think we need to do all of that. But for me, we also shouldn't ignore what I think is the core goal, is to set the record straight about what the science actually says in a particular domain.
Are you hopeful that we can kind of slow the erosion of science's credibility in our society?
I don't know if I'm hopeful, but I think it's really important to try. You know, I'll take that back, because I am seeing glimmers of hope, right? You're seeing more people get on social media, more scientists get on social media. You're seeing more concern about this topic. You know, and I've been following this for a very long time, and I'd say just over the last couple of years, maybe even the last 18 months, you see more headlines about the adverse impact of misinformation in the domain of health. You see more headlines about how this advice is crazy, and some of it is mocking, which is always isn't great, but at least we're starting to talk about misinformation more. And I think part of it is the result of Donald Trump, to be honest with you, and this, you know, this pushback to this concept of fake news, and we're starting to see how the spread of misinformation can have an impact, not just in health, but on democracies more broadly.
Anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. You know, I do think that, you know, engaging these kind of communities is really important, and I really enjoy the opportunity to do it because, the agricultural community is so important, obviously to food production, but also, they are businessmen. They want to do they're engaged with the science, and they're also engaged with the public. So I feel fortunate to have this opportunity.
Great. Well, thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Lisa, he's pretty passionate about this. How did the producers at the meeting react to his presentation?
They were really engaged. At times, there was almost uproarious laughter, but they were you could tell people were really thinking about what he was saying, and they had lots of great questions about how to engage the public and answer some of those tough questions that the public's throwing at them these days and encounter those celebrity trends.
What is the thing that stood out most about his presentation with you?
I was honestly a little bit shocked at some of the health and beauty trends. And he's really funny at times, but it was also, there's some really serious concerns about what people are doing to their bodies and telling other people to do. That was kind of my biggest takeaway.
That some of this is really unhealthy, and yet it's being portrayed as being something that they should be doing for their own health.
Yeah, or outright dangerous. For example, people have been subjecting themselves to bee stings in the face as a beauty trend. There's lots
that
of ways
sounds
that can
like
go
fun.
Really wrong,
So next up, we have Sylvain Charlebois, also known as the food professor. What was he about?
So Charlebois has done a lot of work researching food value chains and food safety issues. And he's got 5 books out on global food systems. And as you know, he's a prof at Dalhousie University. So he talked about some of the really big challenges ahead for the beef sector, but also the opportunities.
So one thing that really struck me was you talked about how most of the vegans are under the age of 38, and there's about 6.4 million Canadians that are looking at reducing or eliminating meat from their diet. So what does this mean for beef producers?
Well, it means that they're going to have to not change their message, but they're going to have to really position their product a little bit differently. I think it's inevitable some people will just walk away from the product. The numbers are telling us that. But it's the flexitarians that I think are an opportunity for the beef industry. They're walking away from the product for one reason or another, whether it's animal welfare or the environment or health. It's to look at these factors and see how can you position beef differently with climate change, and there's some strong arguments there, with animal welfare. You know, how do you make the whole chain transparent? Health as well. So going back to my analogy of mixing things a little bit, considering beef as an ingredient, more so than just like a standalone staple. That I think that's really important for the industry to look into. So down the road, well, you get some business, you just don't lose it all. Yeah, from every mouth in the country, I guess.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting too, your suggestion to partner, for example, with the pulse industry and encourage people to make meatloaf with lentils in it, for example.
Why not? Yeah, absolutely. Mixing recipes around, I think it's important because people will see that the industry is actually making an effort to connect with consumers, because they're coming from a different angle, saying, well, I'm concerned about climate change. Well, we're concerned too. We feel the same thing. But of course, because of this narrative, this overpowering narrative, something is getting lost in the translation. So by partnering, you basically send really a strong statement. Instead of just going out and say, please, Canadians, eat more beef.
Now, he was speaking at the Saskatchewan Beef Industry Conference the week before Canada's new food guide was released. But were there really any surprises in that document?
No, not really. It was widely speculated by Charlebois and others in the months leading up that to the release that Health Canada would be advising Canadians to seek out more plant-based sources of protein, and that that, of course, is going to come at the expense of the beef and dairy sectors. Yeah, and Charlebois said beef producers do need to factor the new food guide recommendations into their thinking. But he also spoke about the need to preserve some cultural traditions around food, and I think that's something that we all need to keep in mind as well.
The influence of the guide is undeniable over time. As a new message gets institutionalized, eventually people will look at beef very differently. And so you kind of have to really, again, embrace this change, this shift, and kind of present something different.
And you did talk about some opportunities, like you said, with the flexitarians, maybe women, and even new immigrants to Canada. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so lots of people have come to Canada, and they make Canada their new home. But of course, they bring along their cultural, their culinary traditions as well. And so, of course, lots of people may have never seen a glass of milk or a piece of beef. And I think it's perhaps time for the industry to reach out to these people and see, well, this is Canadian beef. This is part of our culture. The one big concern that I haven't really talked about this today is the fact that as we move into a new era, a plant-based era, I guess, we're losing our ability to celebrate our culinary traditions, you know? And every time we get together as a family or with friends, there's always a piece of meat somewhere. I mean, it's Christmas, New Year's, Easter, I mean, you name it, this is Canada. So you can't just push aside all these traditions all at once. I mean, it's just, I think it's not fair to not only the sector, but for Canadians, to Canadians as well.
So it sounds as though he thinks meat still has a role to play in Canadian diets. What was the takeaway for producers?
Yeah, I think the big takeaway is that producers do need to keep looking for opportunities to promote beef as a nutritious ingredient, especially to, for example, the flexitarians. And another good point he had was that they need to look for alliances that make sense. For example, beef and pulse producers have quite a bit of common ground when you look at things like environmental stewardship, and they're both producing nutritious products. So, you know, people are already incorporating pulses and beef into the same recipes. Why not do more of that?
We had chili for supper last night, which has beef and pulses in it.
Yeah.
And that's very much a part of our cultural tradition. I mean, we probably have that twice a month in our household. So does he see more of that kind of opportunity emerging?
Yeah, exactly. Or what, you know, lentils and ground beef in a meatloaf, you know, those kinds of things. It seems like there's some good synergy there.
So we may be eating less of it, but we're still going to have it as part of our diets.
Yeah, I'll still be eating lots of it. I mean, yeah, I mean, and I, when you say, when the food guide recommends eat less animal protein, who are they, who needs to eat less animal? Like, I don't know what the baseline is. So maybe some people will be eating less, but maybe there's opportunity for some people to eat more of it as well.
So it's not necessarily a bad news scenario for beef producers.
No, I think there's still opportunity there for them. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Lisa.
Thank you.
That was Lisa Gunther, the newly appointed editor of Canadian Cattleman magazine. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rance. We're going to wrap up this week's show with an update on the current livestock markets with Markets Farm reporter Glenn Halleck. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Pretty good. And yourself?
I'm well. It's trying to stay warm. How are the prices looking these days in the cattle markets?
Prices for mid-size and smaller feeder cattle have gone up roughly $3 to $5, while the heavier feeder cattle are staying roughly the same.
So do you have any idea what's prompting that? I mean, I'm wondering if deliveries are down just because of the kind of weather we're having.
Well, from what we understand, you know, local and Western orders are doing pretty good, and there's still a lot of cattle going to the east.
And then are any thoughts on what producers should be keeping an eye on in the weeks and months ahead?
Well, as one fellow told us, watch the feed pail. If heifers get a little too fleshy, you might lose some money on them. And also, Ag Canada's livestock tax deferral added a few more areas that are now eligible for the tax deferral. Lakeshore here in Manitoba, some municipalities in Saskatchewan and Alberta, and now Ontario.
So these are producers who are able to defer the tax implications of having to downsize their herds for during the drought last year?
Yes. If you reduce your herd by at least 15%, you get to defer some of your income tax on that sale. If you reduce your herd by 30%, then you get to defer 30% of the income.
So that should be a real help to producers who are trying to navigate through that.
Yes, it should.
All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Glenn.
Okay, thank you.
That's all we have for you this week on Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.